each meaningless thought. The shell appears strong, but the inside is rot. It's time to be stirred. The time is now. The winds have changed. Read the signs. No time to hide. The winds have changed.
Millennia ago, from the little cave on the tiny island of Patmos in the Aegean Sea, the heavens opened. Since then, the world has been fascinated by the cosmic upheaval brewing on the horizon of history. The upheaval is now upon us. It is within us. To some degree, it always has been. But there has been a sudden and violent shift in the affairs of the world. The winds have changed. Heaven will not be silent. Let's now join Father Anthony Bush, pastor of St. Stanislaus Kostka, the Sanctuary of the Divine Mercy in Chicago, and author of A Mother's Plea, For the Winds Have Changed. Together we can pave the way for a hopeful response to the signs of our times.
And good Monday afternoon. This is Mary Fiorito. I am the Cardinal Francis George Fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center in Washington, D.C., and the DeNicola Center for Ethics and Culture at the University of Notre Dame. And it is my privilege, as it is most Mondays, to be sitting in today for Father Anthony here on Listener Supported, Winds of Change on WNDZ AM 750 in Chicago. And we have a very special guest today to start out our month of February. Did the groundhog hog see a shadow yesterday? I don't know. I don't think so. So I think, I don't know. I think that means something bad or something good. I don't even keep track. But at any rate, there was a very funny meme for those of you who are Catholic listeners that if the Catholic groundhog sees its shadow, then we have seven more months of ordinary time or seven more weeks of ordinary time, which I thought was very funny.
Yeah.
But I have a wonderful guest in the studio with me today, and that is Kira Burke. And Kira, welcome. Thank you for being with us today. Thank you for having me, Mary. Kira has a very special and personal story that she is has been so gracious to agree to come down and talk to us about, and we are really, really happy to have her here. And Kira, first of all, I'll just begin by offering my personal gratitude to you for your willingness to talk about something which I think is probably not easy for you to talk about.
Well, thank you, of course. And we love talking about baby Rory, so I like sharing his story and keeping his memory alive and helping other families in this situation.
Right.
Because you never think you're going to be the one in this situation.
Right. And it's
until
and it's,
it happens.
Right. And then when you are and you don't think you're going to be able to get through it, but then somehow God gives you the grace.
Yes.
And sends the people, the angels in the flesh, I like to call them, you know, to be there for you. And somehow you think you will never get through this time, but you do. And, you know, baby Rory's story, I know, is going to touch a lot of listeners today. And perhaps a lot of moms and dads who have been in a similar situation. So so before we get into baby Rory's story, Kira, tell me a little bit about yourself. Where'd you grow up? You're a Chicago girl like me.
I am. I grew up in the suburbs of Chicago.
Okay,
Arlington
so you're not
Heights.
Really a Chicago
I'm not
girl. I can't. As someone who actually grew up
that's
in the
a
city,
I'll
tell you one quick funny story. I was speaking at a conference in California one time, and this guy is going on about he was from Chicago and blah, blah, blah. And
right.
I thought, I never knew that guy was from Chicago. I go up to him in the elevator. I'm like, you're from Chicago. And turns out he was like from Sterling, Illinois. I'm like, that's not even a suburb. Because he mentioned his farm. And
right.
I thought, where in Chicago is there a farm? So anyway.
No, I'm from a suburb
so
of Chicago.
There you go. Okay,
Arlington
thank you.
Heights. You.
Okay.
And I grew up there. And there, I was one of eight children. I'm the oldest of eight children. And I ended up meeting my husband, Rory.
At a
wedding.
Yeah.
His friend introduced us, but we went to several weddings together during our 6 months.
And so Rory is not from Chicago, nor from a suburb.
No, Rory is from Ireland. He's from Kerry.
From County Kerry.
Castle Island, County Kerry. Mm-hmm. And I met him, his friend had introduced us about 13 years ago here in Chicago. And we dated and got married and had we have four daughters, Anna Mary, Janie, Edel, and Leaden, and their ages 10, 8, 6, and 5.
Beautiful.
And this was a year ago, actually, this week, January 30th, when I went in, the polar vortex was when I went in for my ultrasound on that day.
And so you were expecting your fifth?
My fifth baby. Yes. I was expecting my fifth baby, and I went for the ultrasound, standard 20-week ultrasound, and I wasn't going to go because it was so cold out, and I went, and I'm glad I went. They saw markers on the baby. Mm-hmm. There were three markers, the cysts on his brain, which is a number one flag that they kind of align it with trisomy 18 or trisomy 21.
Okay.
So they had the three flags. The ultrasound technician brought me into the doctor's office, and, you know, you're very emotional. They're not really telling you what it is. They're saying this is a flag for trisomy 18, and I didn't know what that was. They said it's a chromosomal abnormality. And this is usually when it shows up at the 20-week ultrasound. So they ushered me into one of the doctor's offices, not my standard,
probably the high-risk doctor.
One of the high-risk doctors.
Yeah.
And
were you by yourself?
I was by myself. Yeah. So that wasn't great, but I didn't expect this. So I thought, okay, you know, we'll go and I'll go on my own and it'll be fine. And the doctor, the first thing that he said to me when he saw these markers and the possibility of it being trisomy 18 is, we don't want this. This is just, we do not want this.
The doctor said, we don't want this.
Right.
I mean, meaning we don't want to see this, or?
We don't want this situation.
Okay.
And I didn't know what this even was, trisomy 18. So I was just emotional in his office.
Right.
And then they said, you'd have to go meet with a genetic test.
Right.
A tester and a counselor and go over that. And then also,
what were the other two markers? So the brain cyst?
So brain cyst, and like they were looking for clenched, like fingers, fists.
Mm-hmm.
And there is also with the foot, they were looking for kind of like a club foot.
Like
kind
a club
of, but
foot,
he didn't have that.
Okay.
They thought he did, but he didn't have that.
Okay. So he had one of the three markers.
The cysts were the major concern. And if they were seen on their own independently without the other markers, it's usually not concerning. But since there were a few other markers, that's what they wanted to keep finding out, to see if they were an isolated incident or had other markers.
Okay.
So they did an extended ultrasound during that time, like an hour and a half.
So you were still there. They kept you there.
I was still there the same day. So I went and met the genetic counselor with my husband. They had us come back the next day, and they had us do an echo because the heart was another one of the markers.
Okay.
There was a VSD in the heart of the baby.
Right.
And that's the concern when they're together.
I see.
The two markers.
Right.
Those are the two big markers.
But aren't those also similar markers for Down's?
They are.
For Down syndrome, yeah.
So we met with the cardiologist, the pediatric cardiologist, and their main concern was they thought it was probably trisomy 21, Down syndrome.
Right.
And they had us do a free cell DNA test, which is a non-invasive genetic test that you take, and then the results come back in about 7 to 10 days.
Okay.
So after we took the test, we sat down with the cardiologist after doing the echo with them, and they said, yeah, this looks like it's very concerning. Statistically speaking, the chances are very high.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, you can terminate the baby.
Mm-hmm.
So then my husband and I said that we weren't going to do that. That's really not an option for us, that we'd like to move forward with the pregnancy. And then they had us move on to the genetic counselor, who was kind of arranging our case, our case file, so to speak.
Correct.
And so after that, the genetic counselor went over all the information, the statistics, the information, and then we had to wait about 7 days for the test results to come back. And then we got the call February 7th, so this week, a year ago, that the baby had trisomy 18. So they did confirm it. And
did you know to point that this was a boy?
We did.
Yeah.
They told us after. So they told us that there were markers, there were concerns, and then they said, oh, you know, and do you want to find out? By the way, it's a boy. So it was very emotional.
Sure. I mean, because you had four girls.
We had four girls. And we were so thrilled and so excited to have another baby, to have a fifth baby. And then I found out just then and there that it was a boy. So it was very mixed emotions.
Sure.
Because, you're
so who delivered the news to you? Your OBGYN, or does the geneticist share that information?
The genetic counselor called and shared the information with me.
Okay.
And then she had my main high-risk doctor, OBGYN, call me back the following day. I think he wanted to wait till I digested the news.
Right.
And followed up with me and then asked what I wanted to plan to do moving forward.
Okay.
So I let him know that I was going to continue with the pregnancy, and he said that he appreciated my perspective.
Okay. Yeah, that's a very odd way to...
Well, they don't...
probably don't often see it at the hospital where you deliver.
They don't. None of the nurses...
Because it wasn't a Catholic hospital.
No, it wasn't. Yeah. It was one of the larger hospitals downtown. The nurses were absolutely wonderful.
Yeah.
They were unbelievably wonderful. When we had the baby, they told us that they had never seen a trisomy 18 baby.
Yeah, at that hospital.
They were
that hospital, pardon me for interrupting, they also see very few children with Down syndrome because...
Down syndrome as well.
I think just the... I have a couple of different friends who have been in a variety of situations similar to this, one with a rare form of spina bifida, one with Down syndrome, and just there was... one was actively pressured. She was not at the same hospital you were, but she was at a different hospital and was, she describes it as active pressure to terminate. And the kind of like, oh, well, what, think about it for a week because you're probably going to change your mind. And then they came back and said, now that some time has passed, you're sure you don't want to go forward with termination. She's like, no, and you can just write it on my chart. Not an option, not going to do it. But consistently throughout the remainder of the pregnancy, they kept saying, still not too late to change your mind, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Did you feel anything like that now? And so both of the women I know felt what they would describe now as varying degrees of pressure or coercion, you know, that definitely leaned in a certain direction.
I was very adamant, and I think my doctor had known me for so long that
Had he delivered your other daughters?
The midwives underneath him had.
Gotcha. Okay.
And he had delivered my first, assisted in her delivery, my first Anna Mary's birth because it was a difficult
complicated delivery. Yeah.
So he had known me for years and kind of, I think he knew, okay, this is what she wants, this is what she's going to do. But the attitudes of all the doctors throughout the pregnancies were very kind of dismissive. You know, I'd go in for my appointments and, do you want to hear the baby's heart rate or the heartbeat? And I said, well, yeah, if he's alive, I'd like to hear the baby's heartbeat.
So this was would they say that to anybody else? You know, this is just the...
Right. And not only that, the cell-free DNA tests that I had researched, I mean, 90% of trisomy 18 babies are terminated. But this cell-free DNA test that was done, there's also room for error with the statistics of the test and the results. There are false positives.
Right.
There are false negatives.
Right.
So when I took the test and I said, well, there is, you know, the ratio that you're giving me, there is that small window of maybe the test is wrong.
Right.
What are those chances? Statistically speaking, what have you seen from experience? And that's when the doctor said, I have no idea. They're all terminated. So we don't even
know. So the minute virtually every other couple receives this news, they terminate immediately.
Yes.
And they don't even wait for the definitive test result to come back.
Many of them do not wait for the, or do an amniocentesis to give them the definitive answer. Many of them do not. Some of them do. I think it just depends on the couple. But from what I've understood from the doctors, that's very standard because this new invasive, non-invasive test that's very similar to amniocentesis.
Yeah, you know, it's and the sort of, you know, the little side comments that can be made, you know, everything from, do you want to hear the baby's heartbeat? I had one friend who herself was ill, who had a form of cancer, treatable, but pregnant with her second baby. Strong, you know, suggestion. You know, obviously they can't force you to have the abortion, but essentially we think it would be best for you so we can start your chemo right away for you not to delay, for you to terminate this pregnancy and then try again. And she went in and the ultrasound technician, because she said absolutely not, and they found a doctor who had a specialty in her particular kind of cancer who said in all the years he had only ever lost one mom and her cancer was quite advanced at the time they found her, unlike my friend. But my friend said the ultrasound technician, you know, this was at the hospital you were at, said, you know, as he was doing the ultrasound for her, he said, so is this like a special baby or something? He actually said that to her. And she said, aren't they all special?
Yeah.
And he just looked at her like he was trying to get at, like, now, why are you doing this? Like, it was so novel and strange that she would. And she's fine. She went out. She had four other children. She's absolutely healthy today and, you know, has raised a beautiful family.
What my husband, Rory, and I have noticed through our experience on this journey with meeting with different doctors and specialists, and the number one issue or problem is that the babies are referred to as their diagnosis. Uh-huh. So it wasn't, you know, your baby. It was these trisomy 18s.
Uh-huh.
And so I had to, you know.
Yeah, dehumanize them right
away,
right?
They dehumanize them right away so that, you know, it's very easy then to remain or become detached from the baby.
Right.
So when you're, you know, we were sitting with the palliative care team and certain specialist doctors, and they, I said, you know, my son isn't a trisomy 18. He's
my
our son
right.
who has trisomy 18. He's
right.
not a diagnosis. He's a baby
right.
with a diagnosis.
And, you know, any of those disability groups that you know, I worked with when I worked for
right.
the Catholic Church, they are adamant that it is, for example, not a Down syndrome child, but a child with Down syndrome. You lead
mm-hmm.
with
people
first language
mm-hmm.
is what, and that's in their written materials. All of the groups mm-hmm. I worked with disability rights groups said, no, you refer to the human being first mm-hmm. and then to whatever disability or,
sure.
You know, lack
mm-hmm.
of ability they may have.
Well, yes, because it's, I mean, nowadays they talk about discrimination. If you're going to, you know, base the baby on their sickness or illness, you know, that's discrimination.
Well, and again,
so,
dehumanizing, and probably makes it a little bit easier for
them
you
to
know,
do that.
Right, for
mm-hmm.
them to do it. I mean,
sure.
it's I can't imagine, you know, they could have, unless they're, you know, have mm-hmm. completely blind or numbed consciences,
mm-hmm.
could not have some moral qualms mm-hmm. about terminating at that stage.
Yeah.
Well, Kara, thank you for you know. You know, helping us to understand some of the details. When
sure.
we get back, we're going to talk a little bit more mm-hmm. about what you did as a family after the diagnosis and then about perinatal hospice
okay.
and how that was introduced to your family. So listeners, please stay with us as we talk to Kara Burke about her beautiful son, Rory, and his story. Don't go away. This is Mary Fiorito sitting in for Father Anthony here today on listener-supported Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
There is a lot going on at St. Stan's. St. Stanislaus Kostka is the sanctuary of the Divine Mercy in Chicago. There is Eucharistic adoration before the iconic monstrance, confessions 4 days per week, and masses in English, Polish, and Spanish. There's much more waiting for you here. St. Stan's is right off the Kennedy Expressway, just 2 blocks north of Division on Noble. Find out more by going to ststanschurch.org. That's ststanschurch.org and enter into the presence of Christ.
The Winds of Change.
The Winds of Change.
On AM 750, WNDZ.
Es tiempo de cuaresma para reflexionar y ver cómo estamos como matrimonios, como padres de familia o como cristianos católicos. Conferencia familiar con la psicóloga católica Lupita Venegas. Esta conferencia se llevará a cabo en el gimnasio de la escuela de San Estanislao Kostka, ubicada el 1255 Norte de la Noble, en Chicago, Illinois, el sábado 4 de abril de 2020, de 2 de la tarde hasta las 7 de la noche. Para comprar su boleto, pueden ir a la página del internet de la parroquia de San Estanislao, ststanschurch.org, y pueden seguir las instrucciones ahí en la misma página. Los boletos son $30 por persona. El cupo es limitado. De nuevo, conferencia familiar con la psicóloga católica Lupita Venegas, 4 de abril del 2020, sábado. Todos quedan invitados. Esta conferencia es para matrimonios, parejas y mayores de 18 años. No niños, por favor. Que Dios los bendiga.
And welcome back. I am Mary Fiorito. I'm sitting in today for Father Anthony here on Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ. And as I mentioned from the outset of the program, I am just so privileged to be joined this hour by my friend Kara Burke, who is telling us the story. We are just at the year anniversary of her diagnosis, or her son's diagnosis, rather, her son Rory's diagnosis with trisomy 18, which is a genetic disorder. There would be 3 chromosomes on the 18th.
And it's the largest chromosome.
Okay.
So it affects the baby in a very dramatic, fatal way because
right.
of it being the biggest, largest chromosome.
I see. Okay. And so what are the typical hallmarks of a child that's born with trisomy 18? I know, like with Down syndrome, which most children, sure, of course, is survivable. Mm-hmm. And
well, trisomy 18, first of all, 80% of the babies that get them on average are girls, rather than boys. And 75% of the babies don't make it to delivery. They either miscarry or they're born stillborn. Mm-hmm. So the percentage of them actually surviving delivery and living are within that smaller percentage.
And is that because of the heart issue?
So the trisomy 18 affects every single cell of the body, and no two trisomy 18 babies are the same.
Okay.
It affects every baby individually.
Okay.
The heart is a major issue.
All right.
And the sleep apnea, the apnea in the brain, and the messages from the brain are what eventually a lot of these babies pass away from, is the messages are not being relayed to breathe.
I see.
To remember to breathe. So they just kind of go in and out of these apnea spells.
Right. And there are babies who do, though, survive trisomy 18.
There are.
I know the one I think that's best known among Catholics in the United States would be Senator Rick Santorum's daughter, Bella.
Bella. And their family had sent us a beautiful letter.
Oh, did they?
And and gave us the regards and offered to help and talk in any way they could. And
oh,
it's a very passionate, passionate issue for them and their family.
Right.
And Bella's a miracle baby.
Yeah, she is. And Mrs. Santorum, Karen Santorum, is also a former NICU nurse.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And so I think she had obviously the training to know, but I remember him even telling the story about the doctor wanting to give a particular dose of something to Bella to help her sleep one night, I think was the story they were given. But Karen looked at the dosage and said, that'll kill her.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what are you doing?
Right.
Now, whether that was a mistake or whether or not it was intentional.
Sure.
I think they are, they question whether or not that was maybe an act of, indirect act of euthanasia that was being proposed to them.
And also the fact that baby Rory survived delivery and we had 5 days with him.
Yeah.
That's a miracle for him being a boy.
Right.
Statistically speaking, from what I've researched and what I've been told by the doctors, that, we were very, very lucky to have that. So the heart is a major one. The apnea is a major one. It affects every single cell in the body. Some babies have other issues, severe issues, not so severe issues. It really depends on the baby.
Okay. And so you receive this diagnosis. You make it clear to your delivery team and your care team that termination's not an option.
Right.
Stop bringing it up. Mm-hmm. Stop talking to us about this.
Right.
And then what happens then? You go home and you must have just been numb.
I was. But I was numb, but those 7 days of the unknown were so scary as well.
Mm-hmm.
We got our diagnosis. And we had peace in knowing that our decision moving forward, it's out of our hands.
Right.
It's out of our hands.
Right.
So that gave me immense peace. You're going through all these emotions, of course. You're scared. You're nervous. You're starting to mourn the loss of your baby.
Right.
So either way, if you choose to terminate or choose to continue the pregnancy, at the end of the day, you're still going to lose your baby.
Mm-hmm.
In most cases.
Right.
Of course, there's, a few that do survive, a small percentage of babies that do. So that's where, with our decision, we did have a lot of peace in that because we decided, Rory and I, the baby, and we named him right away.
Mm-hmm.
We picked a name after my husband, Rory, because we thought, he's our first boy and he deserves his name. He's our special first son.
Right.
And we're going to name him to also acknowledge him and start our relationship with him right now and humanize him.
Yep.
And have our family connect with him immediately.
Correct. Yeah.
And that's how we kind of did that.
Yeah. My friends who had similar did the same thing. They named the baby right away and wanted to, again, because that's still time with them, whether or not it's in utero or ex utero. And so at what point were you introduced to the concept of perinatal hospice and connected with the professionals who provided that service?
So moving forward, we like I said, baby Rory, we talked about it with our four daughters at dinner and kind of told them about the diagnosis and
how did they take it?
They were very,
because they're kind of little, right?
They were little. They're 10, 8, 6, and 5. They were sad, but they were also kind of curious because they didn't really know how to digest the information.
Right.
So, and because
the whole concept of death.
The whole concept of death. And we didn't know if he would even survive and we'd be able to meet him. We didn't know. So there was a lot of unknowns. So we just were very, very positive and upbeat and said, the baby is very, very sick and God might take him soon. He's not going to stay with us long.
Right.
He might take us before we get to meet him, or hopefully we'll get to meet him before he goes to heaven to see God. And we kept it very positive, where we want the baby to be so happy.
Right.
So the children, so the girls didn't get so upset.
Right.
I mean, obviously they were still going to be upset, but you want to do kind of damage control. And
sure.
also to keep it in a very beautiful setting.
Right.
Which it is.
Right. Right.
Or
right.
it can be.
Right.
So moving forward, you know, I would go to the team started calling me right away, the palliative care team, and they brought us in, and we had my husband Rory and I had a few meetings with them, and we worked with one particular palliative care neonatologist, and she was fabulous. She was very, very good. She was very cautious and very, very supportive. Cautious meaning like addressing the baby as baby Rory. She caught on to that, and she was very cautious and very respectful.
Good.
And had a very, very beautiful demeanor and approach. And they sat us down and kind of went over what to expect.
Right. So let's just back up just a second. So for the listeners who are not aware of what perinatal hospice is, it is a program very similar to what you would do with an adult or, you know, any born person who has a condition, a life-limiting condition. I don't even like using that phrase, incompatible with life, because life is... life is life, and you're compatible with it while you're alive.
But
a life-limiting condition, or who you're in your final stages or months, and essentially that for an unborn child who receives what will likely be a life-limiting diagnosis, the perinatal hospice team begins to work with you while that child is still in utero to prepare you. So that the team of doctors who will deliver you are also prepared for what they might, you know, have to encounter during the delivery process. And also to discuss, you know, palliative care, which is comfort care for that particular child. And, you know, I think, I mean, we can talk about the ways in which, you know, babies of that age of gestation are terminated. There's a variety of ways they can terminate a late-term pregnancy. One involves dismemberment, which is rather unpleasant. And elective abortions are done in the state of Illinois right up until 24 weeks by this method. And, you know, your cervix is artificially dilated over a course of 3 days. And then there's a dismemberment procedure that occurs where essentially the child is taken apart limb by limb and removed from you. I'm sorry, that's very graphic, but that is what happens. Some abortion providers will use what they call the more compassionate method of giving an intracardial injection that will stop the heart of the child. And this was very interesting because I was talking about, this all came up politically during the presidential debates between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump when late-term abortion came up. And Hillary Clinton was trying to talk about it as that late-term abortions are only done for reasons of sick mother or sick baby, which is not true. Planned Parenthood's own statistics show that. Not true. They're done in those situations, but it's not always the case in a late-term abortion that it's for a fetal anomaly or health of the mother or life of the mother. And Donald Trump very graphically described this. But so I did a radio program with a Catholic deacon who also was a veterinarian. And he said to me, do you know that as a veterinarian, I'm ethically prohibited from doing those the cardial shots, the intracardial shots, because I have to pass through the pleural cavity and other cavities with the needle to get to the heart to put the injection of digoxin into the heart to kill the animal. I either have to sedate the animal or I have to certify that it's comatose. I'm ethically prohibited as a veterinarian
to do that
to
on
this,
animals,
but we're doing it to unborn children. And I had never heard that before and talked to another friend who was a pediatric anesthesiologist who has assisted with some surgeries. You know, now you can do unborn surgeries on unborn children at certain, I think about 18 weeks going forward, there's certain surgical procedures. And she said, oh no, when I assist at those surgeries, my anesthesia team is there just for the baby. She said, the mom has a separate team. I am there only to administer anesthesia for the child. And she said, you know, she had done surgery on a 23-week-old child and said, I do an intramuscular injection of fentanyl for that child because that child absolutely will feel pain. This whole, you know, sort of argument that there is no fetal pain and this is a really humane thing to do and blah, 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 blah. So
and like
was that explained
said,
to you at all when they discussed the termination, how they would do it?
No, the heart, they would.
The intracardial, digoxin.
That's what their method would be.
And then you deliver a stillborn child.
And then you deliver the stillborn baby. And the way that they, the problem is, one of the problems is I'm a part of this trisomy 18 group, like among parents. And, you know, you kind of, it's a support group throughout the pregnancy and after you have your baby.
Okay.
And a lot of the marketing and branding of the whole situation is kind of how it's tainted.
Mm-hmm.
So like the procedures you just described, a lot of these parents, and you know, they've been given this pressure from the doctors
mm-hmm.
so many times that it's very hard to be in these shoes.
Right.
Because they're scaring you so terribly with the diagnosis itself and they don't give you any other options.
And were you ever told that the baby would be in pain? I guess that's where I was going with.
Yeah, they didn't know. They said, we don't know until the baby gets here. We can't predict anything until the baby gets here.
Right.
So we're just going to have to wait and see until he's born, and then we can get a more accurate
assessment
of how he's going to do.
Okay.
So they didn't know.
Right.
But in utero, the neonatologist specialist, after another specialized ultrasound, a higher level ultrasound, told me, your baby is doing his own thing. I see him there. She pulled up a 3D picture of him for my husband and I.
Yeah.
He said he's doing his own thing. He's floating around in you, and he has no idea that he's even sick.
Oh.
He's fine. He's doing your job. You're doing your job.
Right.
So
right.
That was just beautifully.
That's very comforting.
It's very comforting, and it's true.
Right.
It's,
he's just a normal little boy.
He's doing his own thing,
right.
And you do your own thing, and he's just move along
right.
and just see the goal.
So they saw no signs of fetal distress or anything?
None.
Like
there
that.
Was no signs of fetal distress at all.
Yeah.
Not at all. And they were prepared when he was born. They would be prepared to treat him if mm-hmm. he needed treatment
right.
or medicine or medication or anything that he needed, but they just didn't know until he came.
Right.
So, but that is the branding and the marketing of, well, I'm going to say goodbye to my baby today. We're gonna put the baby to sleep. If you're marketing something and you're using certain words to soften it,
right?
I think
the baby to sleep.
Well, I think it's also to help the parents too, because it's such a hard situation, and mm-hmm. these doctors do pressure you,
right?
And they do make it seem like there's no other option.
Right.
The perinatal hospice wasn't presented to us until they realized, okay, they're going to carry the baby to term. Let's have them. Yeah,
they're
meet
really
with the
not
going to
change their mind.
They're not
right.
going to change their mind. We're going to. Called right. the team and have them move forward with them.
Right. And that is from the many women I've talked to, because as you know, I've written articles on mm-hmm. this, that's almost universally mm-hmm. the experience. You have to ask them, basically.
Yes.
They do not come to you and say, here are your options. Your options are not presented equally. You get termination,
right.
termination, termination. And then when they realize, oh, okay, they're not budging on this.
Yeah.
Oh, we do have perinatal hospice.
We had no idea what that was.
Yeah.
We had no idea what that was. And also, the trisomy 18, when these babies pass away, it affects the hospital and the doctor's mortality rates. So they don't want that. And that's a really big issue. And ironically, abortion does not affect their mortality rates. So that's a whole other spectrum of
that,
you know,
that kind of
that
death doesn't count. Right.
Right.
It's only if the baby's born and then that's
so
the kind of
that
death.
Also affects, I think, the medical attitudes of the staff.
But did they tell you, I mean, or do any moms ask, hey, when that big needle goes in to go through the pleural cavity to go into the heart to stop the heart, does that hurt the child at all?
I don't know.
Is that even addressed?
In these groups, I
didn't know this myself until this mm-hmm. veterinarian pointed out mm-hmm. to me. Ethically, I can't even do that.
Right. In this group that I'm members of, they that's never been discussed. And I've hundreds of women have posted or asked questions or discussed this. It's never been addressed. I think they're just in shock and they're scared and they want,
right?
You know, they think that what they're doing is what's best for their baby. They don't want their baby to suffer. But in utero, the baby's not suffering.
And this is what made me so angry about some of the comments and stories, you know, that babies were going to die screaming in pain.
No.
And I have a couple of friends who are neonatologists, interestingly enough, and because mm-hmm. I had a NICU baby, and so and my friend was like, "How do they know?" Like she's like, "I treat babies like this. I've never had a baby die in pain ever.
No,
baby in all
Lord
the years
was
I've
here,
been practicing,
he was born when I went into delivery. I went in to be induced June 12th.
Uh-huh.
We carried him to term. He was
so you went all four. Did you go 40 weeks?
Yeah, 37.
Okay,
he was induced at 37 weeks, and I had to have an emergency C-section, and basically they wanted to know if I wanted to continue with the C-section, and I said, yes, if the baby's alive, I've come this far, I'm
going to
get the baby, he's alive,
right.
You know,
right.
deliver the baby. And so they delivered the baby. He wasn't breathing heat. So they resuscitated him for about 4 to 5 minutes.
Okay.
And during that time, my husband Rory had baptized him.
Yeah.
And kind of made this plea to God.
Yeah.
Just give us an hour.
Yes. Right.
So that's all we want is 1 hour. You know, we did your will.
Right.
Give us 1 hour. And as soon as he did that, the baby started breathing.
Aww,
and all the doctors and the neonatologists were around him. It was very beautiful. They kind of prepped me out to bring the baby to me. I was in another room.
Right.
So the baby was so peaceful. He was breathing on his own. He, for 5 days, the doctors were very, he was so relaxed and peaceful and content.
Mm-hmm.
And the neonatologists and the palliative care team, they were coming in every few hours to check on him or whenever I needed anything. The nurses were in constantly, always assessing him, monitoring him.
Yeah.
And he was, you know, I kept him skin to skin on me.
The kangaroo care.
Yeah, the kangaroo care, which really, you know, it stabilizes his temperature, his heart rate, his respiratory.
Right, his blood pressure, so everything.
Everything.
Yeah.
So in other countries, when they don't have NICUs, this is how they keep the babies alive.
Exactly.
When they're preemies, this is how they kind of treat them.
Right.
So the palliative care doctor, would she'd come in the morning, and they didn't know if to expect if the baby would have passed or not.
Yeah.
She'd come in, and she's like, he's still here.
Aww,
and he was, and I said, he is, and I think it's because he's skin to skin on me.
Yeah.
And she smiled, and she said, it is. That's exactly what it is. He didn't sleep in his little cot. He'd just sleep on me, and it kept him, like, healthy and happy and stable.
Very content. Right.
Very
content.
Yeah.
And pain-free.
He was completely pain-free.
Completely pain-free.
He never needed any medication.
Wow.
And so they were always assessing for that, too. Does he look uncomfortable? Does he look like he might need something to kind of make sure he was not in any sort of pain?
Yeah, because my neonatologist friend said, wait, well, and this might not necessarily be with other trisomy 18 diagnoses, but with other children with different kinds of disabilities, they sometimes do need to use a little bit of morphine. But my friend said, you know, you only need to use a very little. They're so small.
Mm-hmm.
And it does, they don't die screaming in pain. And
no,
whoever is giving anyone that kind of, you know, scare tactic story maybe should have a more honest conversation about the kind of pain that's brought on by putting that injection into the heart.
Now, granted, in the hospital, he was fine. Okay. And when we got home, the perinatal hospice worked with us in the final 2 days, and I'll speak more about that.
Terrific, after the break. Well, we're going to go to our break now. Listeners, please don't go away. You will not be sorry for sticking around and hearing the rest of Kira Burke's beautiful story about how Rory's life has gone on to affect the lives of so many other people. You know, he was here for 5 days, but has had, I think, more impact than some 95-year-olds who get to have a long life with us. So please don't go away. This is Mary Fiorito sitting in for Father Anthony today on listener-supported Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
Sometimes in life, we are confronted with the tyranny of choice. I know. Stop or go. Hot or cold. Up or down. This way or that way. You can contribute to Winds of Change one way or the other. One way is to go to windsofchangeshow.com. Then click on Support Winds of Change Show in the upper right-hand corner of the page. The other is to go to ststandschurch.org and click on the radio tab to make your donation one way or the other.
The Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
St. Stan's School has an amazing PK 3 through 8th grade program focused on leadership and social-emotional learning, and is one of the only schools to implement the Reading and Writing Project of Columbia University and the University of Chicago. Everyday math across the board, PK 3 through 8th, by our highly educated and dedicated teachers, your gifted child will be at a higher and deeper level of thinking and conceptual understanding, so they will have a full comprehension of what they're learning in any subject. St. Stan's students are academically challenged with advanced level placement opportunities as their test scores and high school admissions speak volumes. St. Stan's is an integral part of the Wicker Park community, where you feel welcome and at home with other families and friends who enjoy the same warm, friendly, and safe atmosphere for their children. We have small classroom size, which makes a difference in the whole learning experience. Many schools have excellent programs. At St. Stan's, we empower students to be excellent, learn, lead, love. Join the St. Stan's family. It is a selective admissions process. Grades 1 through 8 are tested and interviewed. Call 773-278-4560. That's 773-278-4560. Or stop by at 1255 North Noble Street. That's one block north of Division, just off the Kennedy. More information at ststandschicago.org. That's ststandschicago.org.
And welcome back. This is Mary Fiorito. I am the Cardinal Francis George Fellow at the DeNicola Center for Ethics and Culture at the University of Notre Dame and the Ethics and Public Policy Center in Washington, D.C. And I am here this hour with Kira Burke, who was telling us the beautiful story about the life and the passing of her son, Rory. It's just about a year this week that Kira and her husband, Rory, discovered that their son had a diagnosis of a genetic illness called trisomy 18 and became one of the rare couples at the hospital where they delivered who decided not to terminate his life. And Kira gave birth to him and he lived for 5 days, but you were not in the hospital those complete 5 days.
No. So he was delivered. We spent 3 days in the hospital with him where they moved us to a certain palliative care unit of the hospital too. So you're not in the standard maternity
ward. I see. Okay.
So you're surrounded by, you know, parents with similar situations or sick babies or sick infants. So that was nice. We had to have that support of the nurses. They knew what they were coming into when they came into your room and how to, you know, handle the baby and you and the family. And my whole family visited and we had friends visit and my daughters were able to be there and give him his first bath when he was born and hold him and pass him around and have everyone meet him and take beautiful pictures. So it was honestly a little glimpse of heaven. It was so beautiful. It was such a glimpse of heaven, and it made heaven even more real for us as a family to have that time. But after 3 days, we were moved home for the remaining 2 days, and the palliative care team had everything organized for us, the perinatal hospice nurse visits, everything through a hospice program aligned with the hospital was all organized, done for us. We had nothing to worry about. Everything was done. There was no stress. They took the stress out of everything so we could focus on spending time with the baby and our family. And they did a phenomenal job doing that.
So they really just took care of everything for you.
They took care of every single thing you could possibly think of. And if you had any questions or concerns through the pregnancy, they answered them. They worked with you. They had therapists for your children. They had social workers.
Really?
Everything. They had. They brought in
so
special.
So this is really a very holistic.
A huge holistic
program. Oh, my goodness.
They had brought beautiful books in and little knitted blankets and hats from other families that had lost their babies in memory of their children to kind of carry on their legacy.
Yeah.
That we had. And so many people from the hospital came in to meet the baby. And nurses, when they were off duty, they would come and visit me and help me and hold him and change him and asked if I needed anything, even when they weren't on their shift. And it was just, it was a very beautiful, beautiful experience.
Wow.
So when we got home, we drove him home. I carried him in the car. These babies, they don't go in car seats. They can't, their bodies can't be strapped into the car seat. So I carried him in the front seat and we drove him home. And it was such a happy moment for the two of us just to have him on his own with us.
Right. Without people in the room.
No one was there. The girls were already at home waiting for him. So we got home and the perinatal hospice nurse would visit, you know, every hour, 2 hours, whenever we needed her to monitor the baby, check on his comfort, make sure he was content and happy. She did art projects with the girls. She did little feet prints and paintings and
beautiful,
made little art things to always constantly remind them of him being their brother and part of our family. So that she was always prepared too. The nurse was very wonderful. She was just spent time with our family and answered any questions.
Boy, the nurses really make or break.
They really do.
I mean, this is not to be disrespectful to doctors, but I tell you, it's the nurses that make or. I mentioned, you know, we had a daughter who was in the NICU for 3 weeks, and you know, and the doctor was perfectly lovely, fine man, and you know, but it's the nurses who the ones you bond with. You know,
they are, and I had during this time I had a few friends that had been through similar situations help Rory and I, my husband and I, kind of know what to prepare and to be prepared and to expect.
Right.
And I had one very good friend, Maria, come to the hospital with me when I had the baby, took all the pictures.
Oh.
She had lost a son who lived only 36 hours. So she had been through the same experience with her son, James.
Uh-huh.
So that was very helpful in just guiding us through it.
Right.
So we had a doctor as well, our friend, Dr. Heron, who also helped us make the ethical decisions of whether we should put the baby on a ventilator or not in the hospital.
Right.
And for us personally, we just wanted him to be free of the tubes and wires and invasive medical measures that we wanted him to just spend time with us, be loved and not have any pain for us personally, and just to kind of have him enjoy his time here with us.
Right.
And we
because the ventilator in by that point would not have significantly extended his life, most likely.
And if it statistically, no.
Yeah.
That's what that's what we were told. And it would have just been more time in the NICU versus coming home.
Being at home. Right.
So
which is what which is a calculation people who have elderly people in hospice have to make every day.
Right.
You know, when my dad was in hospice, he was adamant he did not want to be in the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, we got him home, and you know, he died all of 12 hours later, but he died at home, which is what he absolutely specifically said he wanted. He did not want to be in a hospital.
And I understand that. It was a huge blessing for us to do that. The average life of a trisomy 18 baby is between like 3 to 14 days.
Right.
The average mean life span of a baby. So baby Rory, for boys too, it's significantly less.
Correct. Right.
And many of them don't even survive delivery because they are the weaker sex. The girls
Well, because their lungs develop more slowly.
Right.
Correct. It's the lung issue with the boys. And but did anyone speak to you at all about infant organ donation?
No, nobody. I believe you have to be a certain weight for that.
Correct. Yes.
And baby Rory was 5 pounds, so I think he was shy of that. But no, that was never brought. We were never asked that.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think he would have fulfilled the weight requirements. Anyway.
Right. And it depends on the, you know, again, what the type of illness the child's been diagnosed with.
But I do know a few other parents from the Trisomy 18 organization who. Their children were organ donors because they fit the requirements.
Yeah, my friend's daughter was, and it was actually very beautiful. They had a little funeral liturgy for her at their parish, and they did not time this at all. They were able to use her heart valves, but they got home from the Mass, and the letter from the Illinois Organ Registry donation organization was there giving her the names of the two critically ill babies who would have died but for her. Gifts of her heart valves, and
that's so beautiful.
And she said, you know, my friend has a master's degree in public health, so she knew how to go. You know, this is before Google was Google as it stands now, and so you know, to do online research for medical issues was far more difficult. But so she went to a medical library and found out about the waiting list for infant organs.
Mm-hmm.
She said, I had to say to the doctors, is this even possible? Mm-hmm. Now they were hoping that she would be healed, you know, and you know, when, you know, it was funny, she posted her story on Twitter one time and, you know, she said, you know, oh, so you, one comment to her was you were just an incubator to keep, you know, and she said, no, you know, we were, I mean, that you even have to defend yourself to, you know, anonymous people on Twitter, but she wanted other parents to know that infant organ donation was a possibility in some cases, as you mentioned, not in every case because of the weight of the child, et cetera, et cetera.
And I don't remember it's this other parent loss, infant loss group. There was a couple that carried their baby to term. I don't think they had trisomy 18. I was correcting myself. They had anencephaly, I think.
Right.
And the baby was used for organ donations. And that was very beautiful because they saved other people's lives in that situation.
Exactly.
So,
and that's the one thing, you know, it's a very sad situation, but families who have a critically ill infant who are in need of an organ donation, the waiting list is exceptionally long because any child who could possibly be a donor is often terminated before birth.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, again, you don't want to get into a utilitarian, well, let's just have them, you know. You know, in respecting their lives, you often, God also gives you the gifts of saving other lives, which I think is a great consolation to the family.
Oh, absolutely.
Which, as you say, the child's going to die either way. And wouldn't you rather, you know, have the, you know, as my friend said, I'm sad, but I've never lost a night's sleep ever about the way we handled it.
And we haven't either. And honestly, you go through a range of emotions, but it's amazing how you do get carried. God gives you the grace to handle the situation, and you feel like you're literally being carried through it. You're floating.
Mm-hmm.
It's not even, it's an out-of-body experience.
Yeah.
And my husband and I even said how we were when the baby passed away isn't normal.
Right.
Because we were just, people's prayers had made us, I mean, of course we were sad and grieving, but we were taking it in stride, and the grace was carrying us through
it. And probably a peace. You know, God gives you that peace.
We had such peace. His journey, his story was supposed to be this time frame, and We let him write his own story, and that gave us peace.
Isn't that?
We know
that's a beautiful way to put it. We let him write his own story.
And I didn't want to write. I didn't want to end that story.
Yes,
you know. And he was baptized and confirmed. We had three beautiful, wonderful priests visit us in the hospital as well, which was really nice. And just spent time with him. My family was over, you know, and friends came to the house, and we all gathered and prayed the rosary and put songs on for him and passed him around and really prepared the girls, too, that the baby is going to heaven. He's going to be so incredibly happy. We want this for him.
Right.
If we can grasp that, he's going to be so much happier than we are right now. And he's never going to have to suffer. He only knew love for 5 days.
Right.
Do you know how lucky he is?
Yeah.
And yes, we'll hurt and grieve, but we know that we'll see him again.
Right.
And he made heaven very real for us.
Right. Right.
And that helped them because everyone was looking at us, how we were responding. And we were just kind of doing that because we wanted to help our daughters as well.
Well, Kara, we're going to go into our last break here. And to conclude, I'd love to talk about just, you know, this journey for you spiritually, for you and your husband and your family, and how you've grown spiritually and how you've grown in the Lord since your son's passing. So, listeners, please don't go away. This is Mary Fiorito sitting in for Father Anthony here on listener-supported Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
St. Stanislaus Kostka Church is the official sanctuary of the Divine Mercy in Chicago. Founded by Polish immigrants in the late 1800s, this historic church is more commonly known as St. Stan's. One church, many cultures, in that masses are held in English, Spanish, and Polish. The church is 2 blocks north of Division on Noble, just off the Kennedy. St. Stan's has been so prominent in the history of the church in Chicago that the Kennedy Expressway was even built around it. St. Stan's is easy to get to. It is the sanctuary for quiet prayer before the celebrated iconic monstrance. For Mass and confession times and special events, please visit our new website at ststandschurch.org. That's ststandschurch.org. And while you're on the homepage, feel free to click on the donations tab to help in the continuing restoration of St. Stan's.
The Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
St. Stan's School is enrolling now for the 2020-21 school year. St. Stan's School is a PK3 to 8th grade Catholic school in Westtown, committed to challenging students achieve academic and social excellence, led by action and example. Explore all that St. Stan's has to offer at ststandschicago.org or call 773-278-4560 or visit St. Stan's School at 1255 North Noble, just off the Kennedy Expressway, just 1 block north of Division on Noble.
Welcome back. This is Mary Fiorito sitting in for Father Anthony on Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ. Thank you for staying with us this hour for this beautiful conversation we have been having with Kara Burke about her son, Rory. He was a very special little boy who was diagnosed at 20 weeks gestation with a genetic illness called trisomy 18 and who was here with us for just 5 days. But in those 5 days, he was with, among us, here on this side of the veil, made a tremendous impact on everyone who met him. And Kara, we're talking a little bit about the practicalities of a perinatal hospice. One of the other critiques I've seen when I've written pieces, immediately I'll get someone who's an abortion supporter saying, well, who's going to pay for all of this? Mm-hmm. You know, how expensive is this? Why are we, you know?
At the hospice program, everything's included in your insurance.
Right.
It's all covered.
It's like any other kind of hospice, right?
It's any other hospice or treatment that you're going to get, it's covered by the insurance.
So when someone with cancer goes into hospice, you never hear anyone say, well, what's all this going to cost to put you in hospice, you know?
Yeah, right. No, everything's covered, and they work with you, the perinatal hospice nurse, and they have grief counselors, you know, that they work with if you need them throughout the remaining year, like the following year of having your baby and losing your baby.
Wow.
That'll work with you or your family or your children if you need that. So that's available to people, too. So everything's covered. It's like any other treatment, like you said, or hospice care program.
Right.
So
and it's like wraparound services that are completely covered.
And there's so many wraparound services, and they're all intertwined, and it's just a support network for you while you're on your journey, and anything that you need— They have.
That's beautiful.
They have.
That's another common objection I hear, and I just wanted to ask someone, you know, who has had the benefit of going through this program, you know, because I think I had one person accuse me again on Twitter, which I refer to regularly as a cesspool because it is, you know, of wanting to medically bankrupt people, you know, with these kinds of, you know, crazy programs. So that only pro-lifers want to force on other people, as they say.
It's just general medical care you would give any sick human being.
Correct.
Including our most vulnerable infants that need care.
Right.
In their last minutes, hours, days, weeks, months of life.
Right.
And it really is amazing. It's a very, very strong program that really just lets you live and experience your baby and the whole situation and really just soak it up and use your time.
Yeah. And there's, you know, there's a listener, for those of you who are interested in learning a little more about perinatal hospice, I would recommend to you the couple of articles I've written in National Review Online and in America Magazine, but also a wonderful talk, if you just Google it on YouTube, by Dr. Elvira Paravicini. Dr. Elvira Paravicini, who is an Italian neonatologist but works here in the United States at a hospital on the East Coast. And she has a wonderful talk where she goes through case studies of four or five of her little patients. And, you know, one interesting one was a child with Down syndrome, and they had also diagnosed cysts on his brain and thought he had a multitude of other, a host of other genetic issues that, as it turns out, he did not have. He had Down syndrome, but she showed a picture of him. He's a very beautiful blonde hair, blue-eyed, little kindergarten boy with Down syndrome. But she said, other than that, he did not have the dramatic illnesses that we thought that he did.
And baby Rory was beautiful. He was so beautiful.
I saw some of the pictures.
He didn't look like he had trisomy 18.
Yes.
Not that
he was so
that
tiny.
Matters,
I just
but he
remember,
was so tiny and petite. And just, but then again, he was just so beautiful regardless because he was our baby.
Of course.
Whatever he looked like, he was just very beautiful. And he, so the last 2 days in the house that we had him, his last hours, the nurse prepared us what to expect his last few hours of the apnea and kind of going in and out of his
breathing. So that, could they tell
lapses.
That he was starting to pass?
Yes,
we could tell.
Rory and I could both tell.
Yeah.
And the nurse prepared you for that.
Right.
And just he was getting weaker in his color. And so, and honestly, you felt God. And we felt God in our house, in our living room, in the baby's face as I was holding him when he passed away.
Uh-huh.
You could feel it. You could see it. That you were there, that God was right there taking the baby from my arms into his.
Right.
You could feel it. You could just feel the love and the glow and the warmth.
Right. And you know, that's a very important, you know, your child, you know, I'm going to get choked up here. Your child died peacefully in your arms on Father's Day, right?
On June 16th, on Father's Day. We had one Father's Day with him. Rory had one Father's Day with
his son.
So he was so grateful with his little boy. He was so, so proud of him.
Yeah.
He wanted to hurry up and have our next door neighbor, Tom, meet him because he didn't know how much time we had. So he said, hurry up. We have to get him over here to meet him before. He was just so proud of him.
Yes.
We loved him so much.
Yeah. And it's that someone who could be with us for such a short time, you would love that.
Such a profound impact.
But you had been preparing while you were still carrying him. So I think
that was part of it.
You kind of already knew him in some ways.
We did, and he passed away in the Solemnity of the Blessed Trinity, and one of the priests, Father Peter, who visited us, told us that he had a premonition that that's the day that he would die several times.
Oh.
So that was interesting. They gave us peace and hope as well, but we did have a big celebration of life mass for him after we buried him.
Yeah.
My husband and I buried him privately, just the two of us.
Oh. How were your daughters then during that time?
They were okay. They were kind of, the funeral, they were just kind of taking it all in. I think that they just didn't know what to experience.
Right.
But we tried to remain happy and positive for them in a good way, celebrating him being in heaven and having such peace and being so incredibly happy. And now he can pray for us and help us get there too.
So have you felt his presence?
Every day.
He's such
a part of our family. We have pictures everywhere. We pray to him all the time throughout the day. Baby St. Rory, help me find this. Baby St. Rory, help me do this.
He's going to say, help St. Anthony out there, right?
Right. He's constantly as part of our family dynamic and where he's just every day. He's part of our life. We pray to him every single night. We talk about him at the dinner table or if someone's family members are having a baby. Oh, I had a baby. My daughters always tell people they meet that they have a son in heaven.
Wow.
So it was a beautiful, beautiful experience.
Wow.
And,
well, thank you for sharing it with us.
Well, thank you for
having
me, Mary.
I imagine this was probably not the easiest thing to talk about, but I'm so grateful that you did. And I pray that someone listening to this program today who may be facing similar circumstances will hear your story and perhaps make a different decision. So,
thanks for
listeners, thank you so much for being with us this hour. I will post a link to a WGN-TV news story about Kira and also to this episode if you'd like to share it with others. Thank you again for your time. Goodbye, and have a great week.
What's that you say when the world makes no sense? Do we search deep for truth or sit on the fence? Can you see? Can you see? Can you see the winds have changed? We marvel and flatter such meaningless thought. The shell appears strong, but the inside is rot. It's time to be stirred. The time.